From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear this show at KCRW.com. The Day Trippers, Superbad, Adventureland. Director Greg Mottola has made films that are about road trips, both literal and metaphorical. In his new film, Paul, he combines that with two Brit comic geeks and an alien. Greg, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Elvis. It's a pleasure.
Before we get into Paul, I've got to ask you, and I'm sure you've heard this question before. When I watch The Day Trippers, I find myself thinking about Three Sisters. Is Chekhov any kind of influence on you at all?
Yeah, I mean, Chekhov actually is probably my favorite prose writer. So and his plays, of course. But I mean, I love his short stories, and I thought about it a lot. I mean, you know, he really wrote stories about people from all walks of life. He treated class differences didn't mean anything to him. He just wrote about what he saw, and I guess I was trying to do my sort of middle class version of a observed family study in its own ridiculous way.
Because it feels in some ways almost like Easter Eve to me in a very weird way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's probably unconsciously, you know, one of the things that I stole from while I was writing that movie. I think I was just trying to write about middle class life in a way that I feel like, I don't know, I feel like often in mainstream movies it's treated with everyone has a heart of gold and it's very sentimentalized. And there's another genre of kind of suburban movie that's more indie that's, you know, it's sort of the ripoff of Blue Velvet where everything is – there's evil lurking underneath. Now, I think Blue Velvet's a brilliant movie, but there are a lot of ripoffs of Blue Velvet that aren't quite as brilliant. And I just wanted to do something much more naturalistic. It risks being extraordinarily mundane because that's how the suburbs can be. But that's – to me, that's the hell. those are the beetles scurrying underneath the grass. It's just, oh my God, this is boring out here.
We should say too, Day Trippers is about a group of people taking a trip in from Long Island to the city, what they find, and that thing that kind of links you to Chekhov for me. And there's even a hint of it, although you didn't write Paul. That kind of awakening in women and that sort of sadness that basically comes as a consequence of that awakening in their consciousness. That's very much a part of Chekhov too.
I do gravitate toward stories that have good female characters. The thing I'm writing right now is an adaptation of a book that's for Natalie Portman, and part of the reason it really interested me was it was a great female character in the book. And it has that quality of women, you know, it's the Madame Bovary thing of women kind of realizing what a bad hand they've been dealt by patriarchal society, but you know, and kind of seeing things that men are too busy being narcissistic to see. I love those stories. I love Henry James for the same reason.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to the egalitarian Greg Mottola. His new film as director is Paul. But let's talk about Paul for a minute. If you can tell the audience what the movie's about.
It's Simon Pegg and Nick Frost doing one of their pop culture mashups and their inimitable style, a script that they wrote. And it's about these two guys who are science fiction comic book aficionados who are making their first trip to the United States. And their idea of a dream road trip through the United States would be to start it in San Diego at Comic-Con and then drive to all of the UFO hotspots of Southwest America, like places like Roswell and Area 51. And their road trip is interrupted by – it's hard to believe, but it's interrupted by meeting an alien in the environs of Area 51 who's escaped from a government base and needs a little bit of help.
And it's a movie that I think many of us thought would be an unusual kind of thing for you to do.
I was very shocked when I heard that Simon Pegg wanted to meet me on this. We actually met the day that Superbad opened in America. He hadn't even seen Superbad yet. He had seen Day Trippers in a theater in London a long time ago. And it was – they knew that Edgar Wright would not be available, that he was going to – he had a bunch of projects including Scott Pilgrim. And they thought, well, let's get an American director. And I think Simon had an idea in his head that he wanted the film to be a bit indie. One of the first things he said to me was, it should be Little Miss Sunshine with an alien instead of Alan Arkin. And he meant it. He thought, wouldn't it be cool if the film was a little, you know, rough around the edges? It wasn't super slick. And in the middle of it happened to be this very expensive CGI special effect, but we didn't treat it like a very expensive CGI special effect. We treated it like a character. And I think the only thing that was sort of added to that formula was that there were moments in the film that were very clear in the script to me that they needed to feel a bit more like a slick Hollywood movie. It needed to feel like the fantasy movie that those characters would see in their head. So I tried to design the movie in a way that certain scenes are very thrown away and handheld and conversational and like a bit like an indie or 70s road movie. And it slowly evolves by the end of it into something that's a bit more of the kind of late 70s, early 80s Joe Dante movie that these guys want to be in. And, you know, they wrote a really sweet, funny script that let me put it this way. I think one of the reasons I got the job was that I had to prove my geek credentials to Simon, and I let him know that throughout my childhood I watched not nothing, but I watched a lot of science fiction movies. I read a lot of science fiction novels. I read a lot of comic books. I'm somebody who went off to college and then sort of became a pretentious art house geek of my own. And the Comic-Con world didn't exist back then, so I continue to read comics as much until sort of graphic novels came back around. But I certainly spent a lot of time rewatching all the movies that this film references.
It's the treat when I'm talking to Greg Mottola, whose new film as director is Paul. But I guess the other thing thematically that really clearly interests you is the fact that knowledge is a dangerous thing.
I'm starting to develop political feelings about this because there's such an anti-intellectual movement in our country that I was just reading about, you know, crazy James Franco and the fact that he's pursuing two parallel graduate degrees and directing and acting on soap operas and doing all this crazy stuff and, you know, behaving like a polymath. And I thought, well, you know, he's trying to get graduate degrees from Yale and NYU. He may be insane, but that sounds more like Tiger Blood than Charlie Sheen to me. You know, I mean, this guy's got a thirst for knowledge. And I thought, you know what? He's starting to turn into my hero. I'm, you know, just quite sick of the kind of like Tea Party mentality that jumps all over the president's wife because she's trying to get kids to think about and parents to think about what they put in their kids' mouths. As if that's an evil.
Yeah, no, exactly. But I find that going back to even the day trippers, how there is a kind of complacency in just sort of remaining in the world that the characters start off in, and they're forced out of it. And in Paul, a character played by Kristen Wiig, who has her entire world shaken. In effect, she is a Tea Partier. And by this contact with Paul, who passes on all this knowledge, and she's still fighting it even after she's received it.
Well, I think that is something that fascinates me. And when I read the script the first time, that really made me laugh. And I really liked that aspect of the story. I thought that's an unexpected love interest character. You know, you expect the love interest character basically to come in and look cute and stand there and continue to look cute.
And also to the extent that she has a character to be sort of philosophically simpatico with the other protagonist, and she's not.
Yeah. Yeah, no. I mean, there's, you know, as silly as the movie is, there Simon and Nick wrote some interesting stuff in there about that, and I think why can't a mainstream silly comedy also go to those places? I'm very attracted to stories about people who are in denial or delusional about a relationship or their place in life or whatever, and then have to face reality. Reality slaps them in the face some way. I mean, Day Trippers was very much about that kind of having the rug pulled out from under you and having to look at something that's been right under your nose that you don't want to see. And there's some of that in Adventureland, and there's some of that in Superbad.
But I see real parallels between the Parker Posey character in Day Trippers and Kristen Wiig in Paul.
Yeah, they actually do go through kind of the same thing. I mean, Parker's character has fallen out of love with her boyfriend and is not doing anything about it. She's got an itch that she's not scratching, and she's kind of not living her life as a result. And Kristen's character, when we meet her, clearly has a desire to go out in the world and do something, but is just won't act on it. She's too afraid. And it's scary. It's scary to hit those kind of crossroads in life where your own nature is telling you to do something and you're not listening to it.
But also, I think to sort of disguise those kind of sort of unchecked ambitions, they kind of tell themselves that they're happy with their lives at the point that they are when we meet them. What I just sort of find is that the movies in that way that I don't want to go back to Chekhov again, let's do this. They're kind of these familial archetypes. You know, there's the and the parent figures as well. In this case, the parent figure is kind of Paul, is somebody who basically has to sort of sacrifice to learn as well.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I mean, Paul is sort of the catalyst for the people around him, but even he has his own, you know, moment of truth that he has to face. And, you know, I mean, in a possibly sillier way, Simon and Nick's characters in the movie play these guys who are obsessed with science fiction. Nick's a science fiction writer and Simon's supposed to be his illustrator. And they're clearly not 25 years old. They're older. They haven't really done much with their lives. And I mean, for instance, it was important to me that when we see the artwork that Simon's character has done, that it actually is very, very good. You see, oh, this is a guy who has real talent. He has skills and he hasn't really done anything with them yet. The implication being, you know, there's some step in life he's afraid to take. And I remember going to film school with people who I thought, oh, God, that guy is smarter than I am and is more talented than I am. And why is he not working? Why is he not being aggressive once we've graduated? And a lot of people, you know, it's a shame. It's tragic in some cases. A lot of people are really gifted and don't take that step of risking it. And luckily for Simon and Graham, I mean Simon and Nick's characters, Graham and Clive, they happen to meet this this alien who's kind of a cool mentor dude who is not apologetic for who he is. He's just fine with himself, and he may say things that piss people off, and they may disagree with him, and he may do things that are not politically correct or in some circles, you know, immoral. He doesn't care. He doesn't care what anyone thinks, and I think that's the lesson he imbues on the other characters. Ultimately, I hope the audience feels that at least.
But it's fascinating we bring this thing too up about them being older guys, because this is the first time since Day Trippers where you've dealt with protagonists who are adults.
Part of the reason I wrote Adventureland was because I was working on Undeclared, and it got me thinking about...
Is that where you met Seth Rogen, I guess?
Yeah, it got me thinking about what I was like and what life was like when I was about the age of Seth Rogen. But yeah, I was also... I wanted to work with older actors again. I was ready to deal with, you know... Although, I mean, I can't say, you know, you wouldn't call Paul a mature adult drama. But I mean, they're very adolescent. But you know, it was fun. It was fun to work with guys Simon and Nick's age again too. It was as a comedy subject, it's been done a lot for sure. You know, with Judd's movies and
you know, Judd Apatow, who you probably met on Undeclared as well.
Yeah, I actually met Judd originally because he asked me if I wanted to do an episode of Freaks and Geeks, but I was directing my second movie that then crashed and burned. It was in pre-production, and then the plug got pulled on it. So when he called me up to do Undeclared, I literally basically moved to Los Angeles.
Well, there's clearly a lot more to ask my guest, Greg Mottola, which we'll get to after the break. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Greg's new movie's director is Paul. There's more to come.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest is director Greg Mottola. His new movie is about an alien named Paul. It's called Paul. But I said something just before we start up again. It made me think about one of the things that I like about your movies, which is the way you use music. It's a real emotional resource in the film.
Yeah. I mean, I love music. I'm you know, a music collector. And it's one of those resources that, you know, a director can steal from to help tell the story. But I try to do it. I try to use it the right way to tell the story, not to tell you the same thing you're seeing on screen. Not to that makes me crazy in movies when the music is doing exactly the same thing that the scene is doing. Someone like Quentin Tarantino is a master of it. You know, his record collection is deep, and his use of found music is extraordinary. And I try to think about, well, why does that work so well, and what is it achieving? And it often it is because it's doing something quite different than what the scene is doing, or the emotion of the scene. There's a counterpoint, or there's some new third thing created by the music itself.
I guess one of the things about Paul that I like is that the music in the movie feels like the kind of stuff you would listen to in a car in the 80s, where the radio dictated what you heard. You didn't have a whole lot of choices.
Yeah, I think my attitude was that they're renting this old kind of cheap RV, that it would have an old radio in it, that you'd be driving in the middle of nowhere in the Southwest in Nevada or Utah. The radio station you would stop on probably would be the one that played, you know, hits of the 70s or something, that you would want to hear the songs that are fun to listen to while you're driving down the open road, and that these guys would actually know because they're old enough to have heard them.
It's also a way for them to sort of create their own kind of pastiche of America as they're driving through this kind of pastiche version of America.
Yeah, that was definitely a way I was thinking about it too, that it had to feel, you know, even there's some musical cues that David Arnold did. I love the work David Arnold did on the score, and there's one recurring piece of music that sounds a lot like it could be you know, Everybody's Talking at Me, kind of, or even the music that John Williams did in Sugarland Express. It's got harmonica and this kind of, you know, loping beat to it, and it's road movie music from the 70s.
And there's so many road movie touches. I mean, there are quotes from, as you said, Sugarland Express and from Duel and from Easy Rider, and the way it's almost like at some points, like even Tulane Blacktop a little bit. I mean, there are lots of things, those sort of touchstones that you're using.
Well, we didn't have a giant budget, so I felt that, you know, instead of trying to make it more, you know, slick and super actiony, I would try to focus on a little bit of texture. And I did go back and look at a lot of road movies, Tulane Blacktop, and Thunderbolt and Lightfoot and Duel and Sugarland Express, just to – and Easy Rider, just to look at how they shot the American landscape. And And, you know, it's a comedy. You can't linger for too long on that stuff. You have to kind of get to the next joke.
But there's more sunlight in this movie than there has been in all your other movies put together.
That's true. My films have tend to be really nocturnal. And it was a challenge, too, also putting a CGI character out in the bold sunlight. I had a meeting with David Heyman, who produced all the Harry Potter films, and he was a producer on Day Trippers, which is a bizarre connection. And he said, when he was giving me advice on making CG characters, he said, like, just keep them in the dark. Make them pop out at night. It's so much harder to do anything in daylight. And I knew we were, you know, in trouble. But we had, you know, amazing special effects guys from Double Negative, and I think they actually did a fantastic job of making him seem like he had volume and, you know, and texture out in the sunlight.
It's The Treatment. My guest who had to wrestle with all these problems is Greg Mazzola, whose new film is Paul. My guest, of course, who's done what they call in Saturday Night Live a white people problem movie.
That really made me laugh.
We should explain what that was. It's a Tyler Perry bit on the Weekend Update where he talks about what he calls white people problem movies. And Adventureland is about a poor white boy who has a job.
Yes, he's sad because he has a job. I thought that was really, really funny and deserving.
It's funny because there is that sort of thing that which your movies really kind of deal with. The characters are so kind of wrapped up in their own narcissism that the narcissism itself becomes a comic device.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was making fun of lots of people I actually knew from my youth in that movie, but I think I made fun of no one more than I made fun of myself. I mean, I was making fun of somebody who was, you know, feeling sorry for himself because he couldn't go on a backpacking trip to Europe and all these things that were, you know, these are not real world problems. But when you're young and jealous of other people, you think they are. And the point of the movie was this guy needs to grow up.
But I guess it's that character you're talking about in this movie is Nick Frost's character, who is kind of too juvenile and just sort of not really recognizing what he has before him. And it's almost in sort of a weird way you can see that kind of awakening in Simon's character, and he's a little jealous of it.
Yeah, he's – well, I mean, one of the jokes that I also thought was very clever is that when I first read it was that the science fiction writer in the movie is actually quite annoyed with the alien. He's not really excited about meeting an alien. It's not the way he wanted it to be. It's not
– it's not the way he would have written it.
It's not the way he would have written it, which I think will be an interesting parallel on certain fanboy blogs who will not like Paul because it's not – the alien movie that they want it to be.
Are you anticipating that already?
Well, I think – I mean, I've, you know, the film's open in the UK and I've definitely read some people who said things like that, and that's fair enough. I mean, this movie is I think decidedly more mainstream than Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, and I think it was at the script level. I think part of that is because the movies it's referencing are – even though they are fanboy movies, they are some of the most famous films ever made. I mean, these are not obscure movies. Every, you know, Close Encounters, Star Wars, E.T., these are movies a lot of people have seen. But, you know, quite practically, the fact that we knew the cost of the special effect of Paul would be so high to do it the right way, we felt, you know, the movie should work for a wider audience. It shouldn't – it can't afford to really be a cult film. Which isn't to say that we didn't try to inject it with all kinds of, you know, we wanted to work on multiple levels. But yeah, there'll be people who will be like, you know, where are the references to Silent Running or Dark Star? Come on. Where are those? I didn't see any Forbidden Planet references in there.
I guess those will be in Paul too.
Yes, we have to say something.
Exactly. It's the treatment. My guest is director Greg Mottola, whose new film as director is Paul. I guess I find myself wondering at what point Seth Rogen came into the picture as the voice of Paul.
Seth was – when we started to talk about who it could be and we thought, well, let's try and get someone who hasn't done a lot of voices in animated films. And the studio certainly wanted someone who was recognizable to people. And then we realized every single recognizable person has done an animated voice in films. There's nobody who hasn't done it. I mean, obviously I've worked with Seth. I knew that he would bring a lot to it. We hesitated slightly because the character is written. He's been on planet Earth for 60 odd years and no one, you know, knows how old he actually is. But really no one knows how old his species is. He could still be a young guy in 60 years. Maybe they live to be 300. Seth is also what, you know, from the moment I met him when he was a teenager, he's an old man trapped in a young person's body. I mean, there's nothing young about Seth.
That's exactly. He's got that thing that I used to liken to Kiefer Sutherland. This weird thing that some Canadians have, a voice that's 10 years older than they are.
Yeah, yeah. He had that on Freaks and Geeks. I mean, it's crazy, but it's he's got that deep, gruff voice. And there's a world weariness to it. There's a cynicism in it already.
But there's also a playfulness in it as well.
Yeah, there's still tons of youthful vitality. And that was a great mix for Paul, because we really wanted Paul to be someone who loved life. I mean, he couldn't just be a grouch. I mean, there, you know, the
because
way
because Nick's character is basically that.
Yeah, Nick's kind of the stick in the mud who needs to kind of, you know, get onto the program. Paul, as written, is actually probably the most dimensional character in the script. I mean, he has moments of extreme childishness, but he's a real mensch at times. He's a wise advisor at times. He's a coward at times. He's brave at times. He's not just one thing. And I need it. And Seth is a really superb actor. I mean, Seth can act. He really – I've directed him. I've seen what he can do. He is a total natural. So, you know, it was exciting to do it with Seth because he did bring a lot. He really got what we were trying to get and then took it further.
The danger in that is that because a movie works more episodically than your other movies have, it feels more like a picaresque than the other pictures have.
Yeah, definitely.
And I wonder if that was an intentional thing for you too, to sort of have it play out episodically, then how all these episodes kind of mesh or tie together at the end.
I think it was intentional in the script and I
wonder if you just sort of emphasize that in the way you
– Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean I like that about it. I think – picaresque is the perfect word. It's its own kind of weird little fable, and there are slightly different styles to how certain characters are written. Some are more over the top than others, but once again, I felt like the ones that are more over the top are kind of like the agents, like. The federal agents who are pursuing them are more exaggerated. But I feel like that's how our main characters would see them. We're kind of seeing the movie through their eyes in those scenes.
And weirdly, like sort of the characters that Simon and Nick play, they have a self-awareness about their roles in the world too.
Yeah, I mean that goes back to the sort of pop culture mashup thing that you know Simon's been doing for a long time with Edgar. It's kind of, you know, it's not so different than hip hop. I mean, they're taking things we all know from pop culture, they're slicing and dicing, and they're pasting them, they're collaging them back into their own thing, but they're making something new out of it. I mean, it's an exaggeration to say that, you know, Simon and Edgar are the Kanye West of pop culture, but you know, there's something in there. I mean, they are unapologetically taking things that have been done before and using them in their own way to create something.
But it just sort of felt like between what Simon and Nick had done before as writers working with Edgar Wright and your own work on your own, it was a time that you both groups decided they want to do a more sunny disposition film than they had done before.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think we all wanted to make something that was really fun and sweet and you know, in a good way, in a way that reminded us of those movies we saw, the sort of unbridled optimism of a certain kind of movie. I mean, Star Wars and E.T., for instance, are heavily indebted to golden age of Hollywood films. I mean, those movies really draw so much of their strength from and ideas and style and tone from things that had happened in the 40s. Or, you know, Wizard of Oz or whatever. And we were sourcing some of that. I mean, I think we're trying to get back into our heads of what it felt like. For me, I was 12 when Star Wars came out. And that, you know, totally changed something in me. It was in a great way. I mean, it really made me see movies differently. I think the references to movies from the 70s and 80s are it's not just nostalgia, because movies did change then. I mean, special effects suddenly could do things. We could see things in films that we'd never seen before. You know, and that happens periodically when technology changes. Star Wars or Alien owes a lot to 2001 and so forth, but they took it to the next level. And you know, as a kid, as a 12-year-old, you feel like someone's beaming your dreams onto the screen. And I think we wanted a little bit of that naive quality. Maybe because we live in a world that's so – this movie is extremely naive and innocent in a way that the world is not. It's not a cynical, knowing kind of movie. And some people are going to find that refreshing, and some people are going to just feel it's maybe out of touch.
Well, I'm not among them. I like the movie a lot. Thanks so much for being here, Greg.
Oh, thank you.
My guest is Greg Mottola, whose new film as director is Paul. Our recording engineer at Argo Studios is our own Paul Ruest, who is not an alien. The show is mixed by J.C. Swadek. It is edited and produced by Gemma Dempsey. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.